Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We have petitions this morning. I'll take them in order of their numbers. 04-08, in re proposed amendments to WISSTAT 809-30, 809-32, 809-62. Our co-presenters are going to be Marla Stevens of the State Public Defender Appellate Division Director and Chair of the Wisconsin Judicial Council, and then Robert R. Hennick, Wisconsin Judicial Council Appellate Procedure Committee ad hoc member. Then we have two appearances noted here, Michelle Benke, President of the State Bar, and Michael Heffernan, Appellate Practice Section of the State Bar of Wisconsin. Are there any other appearances here on that rules petition? It's okay. Somebody changes his or her mind, please advise Cornelia Clark. Okay. Ms. Stevens.
May it please the Court, I am here today on behalf of the Wisconsin Judicial Council to urge the Court to adopt the proposals in Petition 0408. I want to advise the Court that there are two members of the Judicial Council Appellate Procedure Committee present.
Is that better?
Present here in the courtroom today, the Honorable Teddy Wiedemeyer, Jr., Wisconsin Court of Appeals, and Margaret Carlson, the Chief Staff Attorney for the Court of Appeals. Also present from the Judicial Council today is James Alexander, who is the staff for the Council, and the Honorable Ed Weinweber. In 1989, this Court asked the Wisconsin Judicial Council and the Appellate Practice Section of the State Bar to advise whether rule changes were necessary to, first of all, clarify whether a respondent in this Court must raise an issue in a petition for cross-review in order to preserve it, or whether that respondent might raise those arguments in support of a lower court decision in a responsive brief. The second thing this Court asked us to look at is whether or not the party should be required to inform this Court of the issues likely to be dispositive or worthy of review in this Court, and whether other issues might need to be decided in the interest of judicial economy. Finally, the Court asked us to look at whether or not clarification of procedures for deciding issues left undecided in the Court of Appeals should be promulgated. The Judicial Council assigned this to the Appellate Procedure Committee. That committee consisted of Judge Wiedemeyer and me as co-chairs, Robert Hennick as a representative of the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, who is the primary drafter of this petition, Margaret Carlson from the Court of Appeals, Beth Hannon, a civil practitioner, Assistant Attorneys General Mary Burke, William Gansner, Christopher Wren, and Greg Weber, and finally, Assistant State Public Defender Joseph Eamon. We went through 17 drafts of this petition between the year 2000 and the year 2004. We feel that we have thoroughly aired within the committee and the council the pros and cons of this recommendation. We sought consensus. We were unable to reach it on every proposal, quite frankly. But we feel the petition is well considered, and it is responsive to the court's request, and it is our best effort. We feel essentially this is a starting point for the court's discussion about what would be helpful to the court. We did circulate the petition for comment to the State Bar Criminal Section, General Practice Section, Appellate Practice Section, family law section, litigation, and government lawyers sections. To my knowledge, only the appellate practice section has weighed in, although we did receive some emails from the criminal law section listserv. Three of them, all three were positive. We also sent a copy of the petition seeking comment to Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, Wisconsin District Attorneys Association, the Defense Research Institute, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, Wisconsin Association of Trial Lawyers, and finally, the Civil Trial Council of Wisconsin. To my knowledge, they have not chosen to weigh in on the petition. There are some miscellaneous provisions in the petition. Most of them are adding subsections. Adding subtitles when they did not already exist as an aid to the parties and practitioners who are trying to find things within the rule. We do, in Section A of the petition, recommend a provision that would allow an early notice of intent to be deemed timely filed. It's an efficiency that we're recommending because if a notice of intent is filed too early, it's not deemed timely under the current rules. There is a saving provision in civil appeals, and this is a saving provision that we're proposing in criminal appeals. Although it is not in the petition, it would certainly be wise to have a similar saving provision in 809-107 in TPR appeals. For what it's worth.
Mostly for the Court of Appeals?
Pardon?
Is that mostly for the Court of Appeals?
Yes, it is. Otherwise, the parties would have to file a motion to extend the time limit because it's not timely, and it tends to drag out appeals. It's
what's
just
that, 809-107?
That's the termination of parental rights.
Yeah, okay.
Section B increases the time within which a response to a petition for review would be due in the no-merit petition for review context. Attorney Hennick will discuss the response to petition for reviews at length later. Sections C, E, F, G, and J add subtitles. Section C divides current 809-62 sub 1 into sub 1 and sub 1G, again, as a means of breaking things out, subtitling, making things easier to find. We don't change the content of 809-62 sub 1, which it talks about the content of the petition for review.
So this is substantively the same in your opinion.
Substantively the same, correct. We're just breaking it out,
got it,
giving it a subtitle. Finally, Section K allows a combined petition for cross-review and response to petition for review for those parties who feel they need to file both. It's, again, an efficiency. It saves a little money for the parties in attorney's fees. We hope saves some trees. All right. I am now going to move on to the first substantive change, and that is... the answer to the question, what must a respondent in the Supreme Court do to preserve issues and arguments for review?
Where are you?
That is in proposed Section D of the petition on page 5. And in short, what the counsel is recommending...
A on page 2, just so we keep up with you. To be handled, is that right? You're not going to say anything more.
I'm not going to say anything more.
On timing, got it.
On timing, right.
Okay. 809-32-4, who's going to handle the 14 to 30 days?
Rob can handle that in the context
got
of
it.
Talking about the response.
Right. 4 is not substantive. 5 is where you are now. Page
correct.
5.
Okay.
Just so we're all
on the same page. Right.
Literally.
In short, what the Judicial Council is recommending is that a respondent only be required to file a petition for cross-review if the Court of Appeals decision is adverse to that respondent. That's not really different from the current rule. What's a little bit different here is that we propose a definition of what an adverse decision is. And we do that because the case law was pretty well settled in Neely that you just can't file a petition for review for any reason. There must be an adverse decision. In State versus Castillo, the question really became, well, what if the decision is adverse to you in some respect and not in others? And what the Judicial Council is recommending is that adverse decision be defined broadly so that a final order or decision of the Court of Appeals, the result of which is contrary in whole or in part to the result that the respondent in this court sought.
Let me give you an example. A civil trial, a defendant loses. Court of Appeals says, you're right, defendant. The trial was had error. And go back and do it again. Orders a new trial. The defendant really wants no new trial once it's stopped.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Wants to win the whole thing. Defendant has won half a loaf. He's got rid of a judgment, but is subject now to another trial. I assume that's an adverse decision.
Correct. And another example in the civil context, I mean, typically the issues are liability or damages, and there may be an error with respect to costs. What could happen is that that party could prevail in the Court of Appeals on the cost issue, which is really a minimal issue. It was something they had to raise because, there's only one appeal as of right. But the really significant issue for this party is damages or liability. And we feel that unless adverse decision is defined in this way, really important issues will escape review.
Counsel, can you tell me, please, whether you think Section 1R applies to someone who was not the appellant, but who had prevailed at the trial court but lost at the Court of Appeals? Because as I read it, it appears that, quote, the party that's referred to is the party seeking review in the Court of Appeals, and when that party didn't get the relief that party requested, then you talk about whether that's adverse. But could get an adverse decision because you won below but you lost at the Court of Appeals. And I was a little concerned about the wording for that. Do you think it's taken care of in there? And I mean,
well, it may very well be that it could be more clearly drafted. Certainly I don't work for the Legislative Reference Bureau. But what is intended
is
a result in the Court of Appeals because this court reviews the Court of Appeals decision.
No, but not always. We use bypass and certification, so that would be an adverse decision that we're talking about on the circuit court level.
Correct, but what we're really talking about here is the petition for review.
Okay, and okay. Is that what the 962 is, a petition for review context?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Ms. Stevens, I've got another question, and I find this in your comment in the Judicial Council Committee note to the proposed rule change, and I'm quoting, this confusion arises from a perceived conflict between the meaning of that term applied in State versus Castillo with the citation and a previously stated in Neely versus State with the citation. Now, I went and looked at those two opinions, especially I have some concern because I was the author for the Court of State versus Castillo. And when I read the language, I don't see any conflict whatsoever. When I look at Neely, and I'm quoting from page 758 of Neely, in the instant case, the result of the appeal was the affirmance by the Court of Appeals of Neely's judgment of conviction. The affirmance was not adverse to the state, and therefore, under Rule 809.62.1, the state cannot petition for review of the decision. Then I go to Castillo, page 492, paragraph 10. The Court of Appeals reversed the circuit court and remanded to allow Castillo to withdraw his admission consistent with his alternative request for relief. Therefore, the mandate or outcome was favorable to him, and he may not properly petition this court for review. How are those in conflict? Sounds like identical situations.
What we are trying to get at here is what I was talking about before, that a decision can be adverse to a party in one respect and favorable to a party in another respect. And if conflict is not the correct term, what the council is trying to recommend here is that in those instances, a party should not be precluded from seeking review of a very important issue to that party. Castillo was allowed to withdraw his plea, but I believe the other argument that he raised on appeal was sufficiency of the evidence. Is that correct?
I think so.
I can't remember.
But what he got was a reversal and a remand to the circuit court. And basically, this court held that was not an outcome adverse to him. And in Neely, what you had was a situation where the state got an affirmance, and this court held that that was not adverse to the state. Seems to me those are identical in terms of looking at the bottom line, the result, reversal, affirmance. I just don't see a conflict.
Well, perhaps then the court wouldn't want to include anything in this comment if it feels that it's confusing. They are not... In the respect that you mentioned, they don't conflict. The respect that we're talking about is really what, I guess, you know, going down a different avenue. What I'm trying to say is that there are important issues to the parties that can't escape review. In the criminal context, in the Castillo context, it's very important to a defendant because a sufficiency of the evidence argument results in a dismissal outright, no retrial. So it was very important to Mr. Castillo to have review of the denial of that particular ground.
I think in Castillo, and I haven't gone back and read the entire opinion, but I think in Castillo there was an admission. In other words, I think there was a plea. At least the quote that I just read talks about withdrawing his admission. Do I understand you wouldn't have any objection to striking that portion of your Judicial Council Committee note in regard to the confusion?
I don't have any objection to this court doing anything it feels is appropriate with this petition. Because...
That's a very diplomatic answer.
Here's what we struggled with, Justice Crooks. You know, we are practitioners and Court of Appeals staff and a judge who are struggling to determine what it is would be helpful to this court. And so we feel this is our best effort at arriving at something that certainly would work for litigants, certainly would work for the Court of Appeals. Will it work for this court? We can't say. We think it's a good starting point for discussion.
And what you believe you're doing is broadening the rule? Is that the idea?
Absolutely. We are broadening the rule. We are recommending that it be broadened.
I would suggest that you'd start the committee note 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 down. 8 lines 9 at the same time, and just say section 809-621R underscores the fact, blah, blah, blah. And then as an example, the criminal thing. And then you could say State v. Castillo and State and Neely versus State. Just cite them and then let it go. I don't think that if the court wants to do that and if the court thinks it's necessary. One of the interesting things is... some of the issues that the court sent as early as 93, and then we're now in 2005, the court sort of were troubling the court at that time. But then the court has adapted to the rules and the cases, and so some of the things don't seem to the court now, or I shouldn't talk to the court, seem to me now is, hey, we're handling that. So your comments are very well taken, and every time you change the rules, both the bench and bar have to readapt to them and take care. But I think there are many things in here, including this, from my perspective, look very good. So we shall proceed.
Is there anything else, Justice Brooks?
Marilyn.
My
question's been asked.
Thank Justice you. Prosser, did you?
Were you the author of the text on page 6?
On page 6, actually, my esteemed colleague, Attorney Hennick, was the author of the language on page 6, and he will succeed me up here, or he can come up here right now.
I don't think you've done
the faster the better, right?
Okay.
It's my intent would not be to in any way embarrass the author of this text, but perhaps inquire what was in your mind when you wrote it. I mean, I'm interested to find out. I'm not interested in debating or criticizing or anything of that sort.
Sure, come on up, Ron.
Mr. Hennick.
Thank you, Young. When I drafted that, although I understand that there probably is no actual conflict, there is a pretty solid group of people in the legal community who perceive a conflict between Neely and Castillo. I think that the basis for that is that if you actually look at what Mr. Castillo was requesting, he was requesting either specific performance. It wasn't sufficiency. What it was a 980 petition. He agreed that, he was certifiable as a 980. The question was whether he would receive supervised release in the community or whether he would have to go to the Wisconsin Resource Center, and there was an agreement that the state would recommend that he be supervised in the community. There then was some problem and he wasn't able to be supervised in the community. The appeal actually sought three things. One was specific performance. Two, if specific performance was not available, that the provision, the 980 provision, be declared unconstitutional, at least as applied to him, and only three, that he be allowed to withdraw the admission. And the way that I perceived Castillo to avoid any conflict with Neely is that Mr. Castillo didn't prioritize those things. If he had prioritized those, saying, I want specific performance, then I can see that what the court did could be viewed as inconsistent with Neely. Because specific performance is different than going back and starting all over where he has a risk of being sent to the Wisconsin Resource Center. Specific performance would get him the initial result that he requested and that the state had agreed to. So the way that I read Castillo is that there must not have been a prioritization of those things. He basically said either A or B or C. And since he got one of the three that he asked for, there's no conflict, there's no adverse decision against him. However, if the actual situation is a prioritization of things, the analogy is sufficiency of the evidence argument, new trial argument, or sentence modification, if you only get sentence modification, that's still an adverse decision to the extent that you are denied dismissal of the count on sufficiency grounds or a new trial.
If I can rephrase your point, Mr. Hennick, as I understand it, what you're saying is that in the past, if under the current rules, if a party got part of what they asked for, that would not constitute an adverse decision. And what you're proposing in the rule is that if you get only part of what you're asking for, the other part that you didn't get may be adverse to you. Is that the difference?
Yes, I would disagree with one thing that Ms. Stevens said. I don't believe that we are actually broadening. I think we're clarifying it. My perception has always been that, in the situation where you have, for instance, sufficiency and asking for a new trial and sentencing, my position has always been that that's an adverse decision if you don't get the top thing that you wanted. And I don't remember seeing any court decision that disagrees with that. So I think we just want to clarify this, and and take care of the people in the community that believe that Castillo is inconsistent with Neely, and say, well, this is what is really meant. Whatever happened in the past, we don't have to worry about, perception of the cases. This is what is meant. If you don't get the relief that you requested, even if you get some lesser relief, it's an adverse decision to the extent that you don't get everything you wanted.
Do you object to my revising your language?
I have no problem with that at all. The reason that we put it in there is because there is a perception in some parts of the legal community.
Question is whether in the other parts that don't think there's a problem, that you raise this, everybody says, what are they talking about?
No objection.
Okay, good. All right.
Could I ask Mr. Hennick, since I have not read the Castillo decision and was not here at the time, Do you think there was a conscious, deliberate effort on the part of the court to draw a distinction? Or is it a distinction or apparent or possible conflict that people are reading into it?
There's nothing that I can recall in the Castillo decision that indicates whether the request of relief was prioritized. I don't think that there's anything in the decision itself that, you know, would say that this is necessarily inconsistent with Neely or any facts that would show that it's inconsistent with Neely.
And it hasn't been interpreted that
no.
way.
No.
That's why I raised that issue with Ms. Stevens, because a lot of this gets settled out.
Mm-hmm.
But it should be clear for the lawyers,
yes.
even if it has become clearer for the court.
Yes, the concern that I have is that it may be clear to the court, but if it's not clear to the practitioners, then they may not bring the petition for review that would be appropriate or a petition for cross review.
And then we have ineffective assistance of counsel cases instead of the merits of the case.
Or malpractice cases on the civil side.
Okay. You yield.
All right, the second piece of...
Before we get to the second piece, I am interested in focusing on this 1R, the result of which is contrary. Here's my hypothetical. Tell me if there's any avenue of relief for the insurance company. The insurance company loses in the trial court, appeals to the Court of Appeals. Now we're dealing here with just a petition for review and what matters, I guess. But my facts are these, that the insurance company wins, that is, the result is it doesn't pay. But in the course of getting to that, the insurance company views the appellate decision as having huge ramifications for the exception to the exclusion of UIM.
Ooh.
And, of course, we had embraced that with vigor. So, in other words, in my hypothetical, it has great consequences. The discussion has great consequences for the insurance companies and their multitude of policies. But with regard to the result, the reasoning of the court, whatever it was, ended up saying insurance company don't pay. What's the insurance company to do when the rationale strips away, they perceive, an interpretation of a provision, and yet the result, did you win or lose, is not adverse?
Under the current rules, that the insurance company cannot file a petition for review because the Court of Appeals result is not adverse to them. The insurance company could file a motion for reconsideration in the Court of Appeals and ask the court to take a look at the rationale. And I know the Court of Appeals, since this court promulgated that rule in 2000, has used that motion for reconsideration to address some factual problems and some... precedent-type problems in the decisions and issued, amended. decisions. I'm not sure that we'll ever really resolve the tension between this court's desire, shall we say, to take an issue, whether the result was adverse or not to a particular party, unless someone else in that case files something, it's not going to find its way up here under your scenario.
That is the present rule, and it has come up, I think, with some but not a lot of frequency with the state. The state wins on the conviction being upheld in a criminal case, but really is in distress about some language in the opinion, and it has attempted to come up here and get it changed, and we said, you won, you got to go home. What happens in those cases, though, in a next case, the state will try and bring up that form issue that it couldn't when it loses, and will try and overturn that Court of Appeals case. So you will see a case where the state really doesn't care if it wins or loses on the conviction. Second case, but it does care that it gets rid of a sentence or whatever in the following case. And so when you press the state here to why they're getting review here, it really is a case as to the language, either in the preceding case or in that case. So then I noticed that Attorney Michael Heffernan's letter on the Foley stationery says on page 2, second paragraph, this concern appears to be mostly hypothetical rather than real, however, because it's hard to imagine a party having won below putting that decision in jeopardy by seeking Supreme Court review solely because of an objection to the rationale that gave victory below. Accordingly, the board approves this codification of Neely, but requests the Supreme Court to consider whether the adverse decision rule is consistent with its lawmaking and authority and necessary to the administration of justice. And I think that's the issue that Justice Bradley is raising. But if the court should go the other way than it has, then you might have just umpteen petitions for review up here or petitions to correct many, many sentences or paragraphs.
Well, that really is the tension.
Okay.
It's the floodgate issue as opposed to let us take a look at it. Let us decide what we want to review.
Okay.
Is there a way for a party in the position of the insurance company to petition the publications committee not to publish?
I believe that a letter can be submitted. Is that accurate?
Mm-hmm.
Does that ever happen?
Yep.
The members of the Court of Appeals are nodding their heads yes.
Let the record show.
Okay.
All right. The second piece of the answer to this question is contained in Section I on pages 11 through 13. And it is an amendment, what appears there is former Rule 80962 sub 7, and we thought it made more sense to move it up in 80962, so we've renumbered it from sub 7 to sub 3M. And there we clarify that if you are seeking to defend the Court of Appeals result, a petition for cross-review is not required. Arguments and issues should be raised in the respondent's brief and included in the response to the petition if one is filed. Again, this is, I think Mr. Hennick actually put it it very well when he said that there are certain people out in the community, the legal community, who feel that this is a very confusing area of the law based on what happened in State versus Scheidel. Up until Scheidel, it seemed very clear that a prevailing party could raise issues if the court could raise its own issues if the court grants the losing party's petition for review, and that a petition for cross review was not needed when all that the prevailing party in the Court of Appeals wanted to do was to raise an error that, if corrected, would again sustain that Court of Appeals decision. And in Johnson and in JML, the court had stated that the proper way for a respondent to raise that issue before this court, if that issue would support the Court of Appeals decision and wasn't addressed there because the Court of Appeals had found another issue dispositive, was to just assert that in its Supreme Court brief. And Scheidel seemed to say that no, what that person would have to do is file a petition for cross-review. So what the council is recommending is that the language in Scheidel, that the court back away from that language and place into the rule sub A and sub B of the new 3M. So that it makes clear that a petition for cross-review is not necessary to enable an opposing party to defend a Court of Appeals result or an outcome on any ground, whether or not the Court of Appeals rules on it, as long as this Court's acceptance of that ground doesn't change the result below.
Now, counsel, sometimes when we get petitions for review, we'll have seven issues, and the court will say, we only want three of these. And we discuss those issues, and so the other four are not law developing, and we're not going to take it. Going with the suggestion of no need to file a cross petition, if the issue would support the mandate of the Court of Appeals, doesn't that allow some issues to appear on our plate that we never would have taken had it been brought to our attention initially?
Well, I think that's probably true. But what the council is recommending is that this tension between your right to limit issues and a party's right to raise an alternative ground in support of affirmance should fall towards the latter. And we say that because we feel that there are some policy reasons to do that, that it does support finality of judgments, that it does give the parties a full and fair hearing before this court, and because, you know, the parties only have one appeal as of right, and they are required to raise all of their issues on the record, outside the record, in this appeal as of right. And it probably promotes, I say probably because I'm not certain, it probably promotes better decision-making up here when all of the sub-issues, this court is at least aware of all of the sub-issues and all of the other alternative rationales for supporting the decision below. The court can decide to reject them. So that's the reason why we came down on that side of the tension.
I guess the concern that I have in response to what you've just said is that we just had a case last week where a petition for review was filed. One party opposed the petition being granted. We granted the petition on the one issue that was raised. There were four or five other issues that were not raised in the petition or the response that had not been decided by the Court of Appeals, and we were confronted with six issues. And I don't know which side I favor, but I think that's the issue the court is concerned about. We were now dealing with six issues instead of one that we thought we had taken the case for.
And excuse me, and a lot of times our debate whether we'll take an issue is on exactly what Justice Butler is talking about. So that's, I'm just wondering just mm-hmm. how that would act as far as this court and even taking the case then.
Well, again, this is part of a whole package, and the other pieces of the package that I'm about to cede the microphone to Mr. Hennick to talk about are what is a respondent's responsibility to inform this court?
Let me just say, court has switched on you from a cross petition to the petition. Both Justice Butler's question and Justice Wilcox's deal with the petition for review, and you are about to say that 3M is the cross petition.
3M is the cross petition, and our new proposal for a response to the petition addresses some of these issues.
Okay, just so that the switch is absolutely clear. Well, maybe it's not clear, but it's what I think.
So, Mr. Hennick, do you want to pick up?
Yes, the issue that Ms. Stevens was just speaking about is when things have to be in a cross petition rather than a response. As you pointed out earlier, we basically addressed three issues in the, or three, I don't want to use issues because there's,
Don't use argument.
Matters or concerns.
Okay.
We addressed three matters or concerns. The first was, you know, this whole issue of when you have to file a cross petition, when you have an adverse decision. The second, which is, I think, what actually got this ball rolling, such as it was back in 1993, concerns the court's concerns over what Justice Butler was just talking about, which is you get a petition.
Hennick, I'm just going to interrupt you. You're talking now about 809-62-2, contents of the petition, 2A.
Yes, and also.
So we know where we are.
On page what?
Six. Bottom of six.
Bottom of eight also, aren't you on? 809.
Move to the response, which is at the bottom eight, but first he's talking about the contents of the petition, and the last three sentences say the statement of issue must identify any issues on which the petitioner seeks review that were not decided by the Court of Appeals. Statement of issue will be deemed a compromise. To comprise every subsidiary issue. So if the Court of Appeals rules on issue A, which it views as determinative and doesn't go through B through Z, we might get in the appeals, in the brief, a statement of all those issues, even though the petition for review is limited. And they may spend time in the brief, or they may say nothing, and then in their conclusion paragraph say, please remand to the Court of Appeals for issues B through Z. That's what this is talking about.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
Actually, there are two different concerns, two different matters. First is what information has to be provided to the court or should be provided to the court so the court can make an informed decision of whether to take this particular petition for review, whether to limit the issues as the court has the authority to do. Back in 1993 when this started rolling, that I believe was the court's primary concern. I know that the minutes from the Judicial Council indicate that Justice Wilcox was expressing those concerns, and the way that we tried to address these are two. First, with a petition for review. That's on page 6, the contents of the petition. We want to make sure that it's clear that when you are petitioning for review of an adverse decision, you need to include all issues that you are presenting for review, regardless whether the Court of Appeals actually decided those issues. So in a case in which the Court of Appeals finds one issue to be determinative, doesn't address B through Z, if you want to have those things reviewed, those issues reviewed, you have to include them in your petition for review. The second way that we address this is in the response, which begins on page 8. That's section 8 of the, or H.
Before you do that, I assume that a petitioner could say issues B through Z were not addressed by the Court of Appeals. We do not suggest that you take it, but we do suggest if you reverse the Court of Appeals that they be remanded.
Certainly that is an option. They can also, it is always this Court's prerogative.
I know, but shouldn't the petitioner know that?
I have no problem with including something like that.
You could do that in the notes to that section anyway. That
would be
ask remand for issues that you don't want reviewed.
Yes. And that's always, I think it's Jamie L. that says that the court has the three options. If you have a decision in the Court of Appeals which doesn't address all of the issues.
Right. Sometimes we send it back, sometimes we don't. We're not always consistent when we do. Okay.
Great.
All right. We're now at, unless there are further questions on that, now you're going to go through, C, D, E, and F are not changed.
Could I ask, before you go to those, from your understanding of how the court works, what do you think the dynamics are? What do you think the dynamics will be of this more detailed contents of a petition for review?
Maybe sorry, I don't understand the question.
Let me see if I can articulate. We always like to get cases where there's one issue. Now, that may not be in your interest.
What do you say that about me, Judge?
And I understand the problems of being required to raise issues, but you think there'll be any effect on the court's willingness to take a petition if it spells out multiple issues?
I believe that when the court is fully informed about what it's getting into, that it will be more likely to take an issue and use its authority to limit the issues that are going to be raised, because the court will be able to actually limit, a nice discrete issue, you can limit it to that nice discrete issue. You have the authority to do that. The way things go now, like Justice Butler was talking about, you have one discrete issue, appears to be a discrete issue, and then you get bombarded with six others.
But that's the problem, appears to be discrete.
Yes.
That is the issue. But that's better that the court should know what it's getting into, I think, as the petition is drafted, than to be blindsided.
Exactly.
That's your point. That a good drafter who has 25, 35 issues may very well, if they're tipped appropriately in the comment, will say this is a discrete issue. It's not needed, or these are the three discrete issues. The others can go back to the Court of Appeals. The other 1,003.
Or circumstances in my own cases where I have to preserve an issue for federal habeas relief, I understand that it doesn't qualify under the conditions for a grant of a petition for review by this court, but I have to present them to this court in order to preserve them for federal habeas. I state the issue and indicate in the petition that I understand this doesn't otherwise meet the qualifications, but I have to do it. But the way that, with regard to the response, the original attempts back in 1993 caused a number of concerns, primarily with the vagueness of the way it was set up, the proposals, and what actually would be required, concerns for workload, how much actual more burden would be placed on the respondents especially institutional respondents such as the Attorney General's office. And I think that was one of the major reasons why there was a problem. And we've tried to deal with each of those things, first by specifically spelling out what we think the court is looking for, what the court we believe probably would require to make an informed decision.
I have a concern as to why increase the number of days. I mean, what you don't want to do, in my opinion, is build in more time. As it is, from the time we take a petition until a final decision is mandated, is roughly a year.
The reason why we increase the number of days is to address the workload issue. That today, the way things are dealt with, the only thing that's written into the rules is that a response, you may file it within 14 days. It doesn't say what you have to include. It doesn't say that you have to include possible issues of waiver or estoppel, things like that. It doesn't say you have to include, identify the other issues that may have to be raised and presented. It doesn't include...
But I like the listing. I mean, it seems good at my first read. What I'm objecting to is why you extend it 30 days.
And that...
A lot of this is really boilerplate. It looks good, but all you have to do is say, they now give reasons for denying the petition if they're going to file something. Defects, it's usually done, if there are any.
The main concern is with the other issues, which, of course, is the main concern of the court. And institutional litigants like the Attorney General's office express their concern that there are cases in which the district attorney handles the case in the Court of Appeals, but the Attorney General's office would be handling it here, in which 14 days to respond to a petition for review is really pushing it, especially with their problems with the number of attorneys over there and just the workload. We thought that an extension to 30 days would help dealing with that. Obviously, it is not a do-or-die issue for the Judicial Council, but especially since the second part there, which indicates that a response is not mandatory unless this court orders one.
Well, one of the things it says, if filed, the response must contain an on D, any alternative grounds supporting the Court of Appeals result or a result less favorable. Now, if you don't put it in there, you don't have to cross petition, right?
Right.
But you still have to put it in your response. And maybe I'm not reading your comments carefully enough. Are you going to waive if you don't put in your alternative ground?
Even
though you don't have to file a cross petition?
The United States Supreme Court rules that part of this was taken from expressly
said. Right. That's the bottom of page 10 is a reference there.
Yes. And let's see. I believe that there is an issue in here about it waiving. The middle paragraph on page 10, which is implicit in these amendments, although not expressly stated as in the federal rule, is the understanding that a respondent may be deemed to have waived issues or defects that do not go to jurisdiction if they're not called to the attention of the court.
I would think that that's just a hidden in the comments. When you don't have to file a cross petition is just...
The reason why they were in the comments, number one, is that there were members of the committee by consensus who did not want to actually make a rule about that. It was the understanding that this court always has the ability to overlook waiver. But more important is that the only time that a party has to file a reply is if this court orders it. And if this court orders it, it's because it wants to have the information.
If you make the response, is it called response?
Yes.
Response at a trap for waiver, boy, I'd never file a response. because, again, you're not sure what you're getting into. I mean, I recognize that, and cases keep changing the more you think about them. The result is bad for the lawyer. One, he or she doesn't get an opportunity to say, court, don't take it. A lot of the responses are pretty perfunctory, you know. Heck no. And or it's not an important case of statewide legal significance, something like that, which is not really very helpful. But this concerns me. I mean, I think you can say or file the response may contain or would be effective to contain. But having a waiver in a comment,
look,
I'd rather put it up front and say your cross-review must have it all. Anyway, that's one person's view at 10:30 sitting up here without having listened to people, but that's what bothers me.
Yeah,
of course, I dissented in Mikroot, so that's another issue.
Okay. We have no objection to it actually going into the, you know, obviously, the body of the rule. The reason why we put it in the comments is not to create a waiver that did not otherwise exist, but to notify parties that there is a possibility of a waiver.
Okay.
And again, one of the things that we try to deal, for instance, with the workload issue here, is to track this more like the United States Supreme Court, which I've had 12 cert petitions filed in the U.S. Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has only ordered a response in two of them. So unless a response is ordered, this should actually cut down on the workload of respondents. The reason for that is that a lot of, I'm sure, the petitions before this court, it's clear to everybody that it's not something that's going to be granted. It's something that needs to be filed, perhaps in a criminal case to preserve issues for further review. But it's not something that this court is going to take. A sufficiency argument, this court generally is just not going to take. But it has to be filed. The state shouldn't have to file a response on that unless this court decides that it should have a response. To make sure that nobody in the respondent's position gets whipsawed, we do include in the rule that a petition will not be granted unless they're given an opportunity to respond. But, of course, a petition can be denied without a response.
Counselor, I'm a little bit concerned about the effect on private practitioners who are not institutional practitioners that may have very complicated litigation and for which this rule might increase the expenses of what is already quite expensive litigation. And I understand from your colleague's presentation to us, the committee tried to get input from other lawyers' groups. Do you have any other means, because you didn't get a response, any other means of assessing how that might impact the costs of litigation for private parties in our court?
Well, we do have a letter from Mr. Heffernan, who deals with that for purposes of the appellate practice section. And his perspective on this is that it would, in fact, cut back on costs, except in those cases that this court believes are significant enough to require a response. So on the whole, I think we are actually going to cut back on litigation costs because we are not going to have to file a response in every petition. And only in those petitions where the court asks for a response believes that it's important enough, do you file one. And in those cases, then if you're representing a private party or whoever, you're going to want to make sure that you do the best job possible on that response to convince the court not to take it.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we don't get a response, it's often from the AG's office or someone that's just swamped with lots and lots of appeals. But generally, if we have complicated civil litigation, we get a response, but we don't always get in that response all the alternative means for affirming the Court of Appeals. And it's that second part that I think this rule would now require, that if they choose to file a response, they have to file a broader response than currently they'd have to file.
Well, one thing that a private litigator would have to explain to his client is, or her client, is that I just filed this complex document. The rules say I don't have to unless ordered by the court. You know, how can I justify those costs if the court hasn't said to file one?
Oh, well, I mean, I don't know. Private practice for 16 years, I always filed a response. But I just did commercial litigation. And I think it depends on the area of practice that you're in and the kind of clients you serve. So.
If you can anticipate that this is an issue that the court might be interested in, then I can see the court, the party actually filing a response without a court order. But I think most of the time, under Supreme Court practice, U.S. Supreme Court practice, I am sure that there are litigants that do file a response just automatically. Most that I have seen don't file one unless the court asks for it.
I have a problem. I just don't understand the next to last sentence. Okay?
Page 8.
It says, and I'm going to cut it up so you can see my problem. A petition will not be granted unless the opposing party files a response.
Either file or
response. Yeah, but that's okay. What happens. Mm-hmm. It's either or. But mm-hmm. So I'm breaking it up just to show you what my problem is. Well, I'll be darned if I'm going to let the one party decide whether this court's going to take a petition for review merely by not filing. So if we are considering, as I read the sentence, if we're considering taking it, we have to then say, order them to file a response, the way this is written.
Yes. And the reason for that was to ensure that a party who didn't file a response initially, believing that the issue was not worthy of Supreme Court review,
Let me go on to have a second sentence, because that will show, I think, my problem, or it'll show that I don't have a problem. So a petition will not be granted unless the opposing party files a response, period. Then, if the court is considering granting the petition, it must order the opposing party to file a response, period. A petition will not be granted unless the opposing party fails to comply with an order to file a response. That's how this is now written. And that doesn't make sense. I think what you mean, that if the court orders a response and the opposing party fails to file a response, the court may nevertheless grant the petition. I mean, that's what I think this means. This is not what that sentence says.
What we were trying to cover...
Are you trying to do what I was saying?
Yes.
Okay.
We're trying to cover the situation in which a party files a response within the 14 or 30 days. Or if the party chooses not to file a response, the court orders a response and then fails to file one. So
what can the court do when they fail to file a response? The court can take the petition.
Yeah.
The way it's written now is a petition will not be granted.
Unless
the opposing party fails to comply, it doesn't make sense. Petition will not be granted unless the opposing party fails to comply.
Well,
it might not be granted even if he does. Reply. Anyway, that's my problem.
I understand. It's language, but what we're trying to get at is
I understand what you're trying to get at. I think it's statutory drafting is hard because you try and put a lot into a few words rather than a 40-page opinion like we write. So, but it has to be cut into a couple of sentences. All right, just so I understand what you're driving at. Okay.
Okay, so the workload issue we tried to address with the 14 to 30 days and this requirement that the response is not mandatory unless ordered by the court. As for the specific items included in the response, the first, obviously, any reasons for denying the petition, which is very broad and general. Second, any perceived defects that may prevent ruling on the merits of any issue in the petition. Issues like waiver, estoppel, mootness, things like that, which this court should know ahead of time before taking a case. It might look like the best issue in the world, but if the defendant didn't object to it at the proper time, then you may not be able to get to it. This court at least should have the know what it's getting into. Third, any perceived misstatements of fact or law set forth in the petition. Each of those first three, A, B, and C, are taken from the U.S. Supreme Court rule. D and E actually probably could be combined into one. Basically, that's dealing with the other issues that would need to be decided, the other six issues that Justice Butler was talking about. Here, I want to emphasize that we are not trying to affect the decision, the holding in State v. Holt, to the effect that if you win in the Court of Appeals, you can support that court's judgment on any ground, whether it was raised in that court or decided by that court. We're not trying to change that. What we are trying to do is just require notice that you're going to do that. So if the party wins in the Court of Appeals, gets a new trial on one issue, but there are four other issues that would support the same result, a new trial, you have to include that in the response. So this court knows what it's getting into. That's essentially both D and E. One issue that may seem a little bit strange to this court is the language, any alternative ground supporting the Court of Appeals result or a result less favorable to the opposing party than that granted by the Court of Appeals. And I just point that out. This language or this idea was taken from a Texas court rule. And what that basically goes to is if you have, for instance, a party who won a new trial, defendant appeals to the Court of Appeals asking for a new trial, and if he loses that, resentencing. You have to include the reasons why you want resentencing, even if you lose the new trial in the Supreme Court. You do not have to do, under our proposed amendments to 3M, you do not have to do a petition for cross-review on that, because you're getting less if you win the resentencing than you would have won based on what you won in the Court of Appeals. Those issues, or those points, I think, those requirements, I think, would give the court the information that it needs to avoid the issues, the six issues that are blindsiding the court. The final issue that we tried to deal with, the final concern that we tried to deal with, is how to deal with issues that the Court of Appeals did not decide. And that we actually addressed in a number of ways.
Give us the page where
you are. This is more of a general concept, and the first is the adverse decision rule. That's Rule R, and that is on page...
Okay, you don't have something specific in here other than the ones we've already touched.
Right.
Okay, and the issue of when you send it back and when you deal with it. Okay.
Right, when you send it back, when a petition for cross-review is required. If the Court of Appeals does not decide it, you still have to advise the court of it, whether it's in your petition, whether it's in your cross-petition, whether it's in your response. If you want that issue preserved, you have to notify this court of it in the petition for review process. The final point on that is Section M in the petition, which is on page 15. We discussed before that the court has the right to limit the issues presented for appeal. All that the change here does is if you are raising an issue that the Court of Appeals did not decide, and if this court limits the issues to exclude that, then the proper response from the court is to remand that issue to the Court of Appeals once the decision is made, unless it's moot.
And parties have become confused about that and have asked us in one rather recent case saying, please clarify that we're not waiving all these 2003 other issues that the Court of Appeals didn't have determinative. And I think we issued an order saying you're right and cited the cases or rules that do that.
Okay.
But if we don't like what you do on response and waiver, we have to get rid of the word response on 1, 2, 3, 4th line. If a petition is granted, the parties cannot raise or argue issues not set forth in the response.
Petition or the response, yes.
That's where it's no longer may be a waiver. It is a waiver. Okay.
Yes.
If I've read it right.
I believe that's probably an accurate reading, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And that's how the rule has been. If there are no further questions, I'd ask the court to consider our petition.
I have a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was impressed with the introductory comments of the presenter before you, who indicated that this was a composite in some ways of addressing concerns of a variety of interests while still focusing on trying to meet the needs and concerns of the court. And the comment was made, well, I think it addresses our concerns. Now I'm generalizing, but court, it's up to you to decide if it addresses your concerns. My question is this to you. What are the major areas that need changing in the existing code from your perspective? I want to try to divide out from your perspective what you have proffered in an attempt to assist us, as opposed to what you really think are the problems that need addressing and are addressed. Are you able to slice it in that fashion?
Well, I believe so, yes. The court's interest versus the litigant's interest. And I think that as a litigant, the primary concern that we have deals with the adverse decision and how to define an adverse decision, and therefore when we can or should do a petition for review, when we can or don't have to do a petition for cross-review. And I think that's probably the major problem that we have. Second would be clarification. What do you do with the undecided decisions or undecided issues in the Court of Appeals? And I think that, you know, we have addressed those in a way that's that it is acceptable to the legal community. There are workload issues with regard to the court's concern on responses, but I don't think that those same kind of concerns or that there's that same kind of conflict with regard to the adverse decision and how to deal with undecided issues.
Thank you.
Thank the court.
Mr. Hennick, I want to go back to page 9. To D. I understand you to say that an alternative ground for supporting the Court of Appeals decision, you're certainly entitled to raise alternative grounds, but if you fail to do it in this document, that's somehow waived?
The way that the U.S. Supreme Court deals with a similar situation, it is deemed waived. And the reason for that is that the reason for the notice requirements are important to this court, and that if it's not, the issue is not important enough to assist the court in its decision whether to take the case, then the court shouldn't be allowed the person who fails to identify them. There is, I think, the Tuttle decision from the U.S. Supreme Court addresses that. It's cited in the Oklahoma City v. Tuttle, discusses that. That these rules aren't here, these requirements aren't just here because the court wants to make it tougher on respondents. There's a purpose for them, and the purpose is to make the court's job easier. And if the litigants aren't willing to support that interest, they should suffer the consequences.
And that's expressly stated in 809-627. If a petition is granted, the parties cannot raise or argue issues not set forth in the petition or response, unless ordered otherwise by the Supreme Court. I view that as a waiver issue unless the court decides it's not going to waive it. And your party won't know to brief it. They can't now brief the issue that they didn't put in their response. Unless they come to the court and say, well, it's not there in our response, but we want to brief it, therefore we have a motion to allow us to brief it. So the other party is going to say, heck no, you waived it, right? Then the court has to decide a motion. We've been out of the motion business a long time. So now we have a motion. Then the court's going to have to decide, without really looking at the briefs, without being intimately familiar with it, whether we're going to grant the motion or not. So one way of dealing with that is say, well, go ahead, but we're not sure we're going to consider it. So now they waste X number of hours writing that brief, Y number of pages, and then we get to it and we say, well, we're not going to figure that out. And both sides have to then do that. So that's why I have a problem with this. Now, one of the things that I'm thinking as I'm speaking is, you know, you have to be careful. I have to be careful to just say, hey, that's a problem, and then say, I don't want another problem. But we have a problem now, which is the one you would point out, of being caught unaware and having the other party being caught unaware. So maybe I'm just comfortable with the problem I know and uncomfortable with the problem that a proposal puts up. So that is the issue. It's never clear cut, no problem, problem. It's always this problem or that problem.
Well, and the new problem that you refer to is only a problem if the respondent fails to do their job.
Yeah. But we're all human, and you just don't see things. I mean, we've seen people at oral argument after they file briefs, they'll say, you know, it's not in my brief, but the better argument is, and give you what many of us might think is the better argument, and the other side just says, well, we've been at this for 15 years, and now they've changed their tune.
And that kind of a situation, the law is quite clear that that is waived if it's not raised until that point, although the court is free to overlook the waiver in a particular situation.
It seems to me, Mr. Hennig, you've been here many times, so many times that there might be a name on one of these chairs for you. It's interesting that we get from time to time counsel who've said that I've been practicing in the state for 30 years and I've never had an opportunity to come here before. I'm not sure that the court should expect the same kind of nuanced understanding of the rules from these folks that we might expect from you.
The Hennig standard is being belonged.
I should have invited my wife on, yes. She's probably been here more than I have. But which is one of the reasons why we want to lay out exactly what is required, rather than having just a rule that we have now saying you can file a response in 14 days. Why we put out in, you know, A, B, C, D, E, exactly what is expected of a litigant. Somebody who hasn't practiced before this court before, even though they've practiced for 30 years, can go to this rule and see, okay, I have to do this, I have to do this, I have to do this. You know, it's laid out there what they have to include. The current rule just says a response. What do? I don't even know what cover, you know, what color cover it is. You know, do I have to just put in my Court of Appeals brief, which I'm sure the court sees a lot of, in response to a petition for review? But we try to deal with that by making it as direct and, you know, A, B, C, D, as possible, so the litigant who hasn't been here regularly can figure out as easily as possible what's required of them. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hennig. Now we will hear from President Michelle Behnke. And we'll hear from Mr. Heffernan. Oh, second reminder, and now I'm going to definitely do it. We have to change the CD. So it'll just take a few moments.
She said okay.
Okay, let's go. Ms. Banky.
If it please the court, my name is Michelle Banky, and I'm here on behalf of the State Bar of Wisconsin. As the petitioner indicated, when the Wisconsin Judicial Council filed its petition, it circulated that petition to a number of groups, including the State Bar. The State Bar Board of Governors took up the petition, and we likewise ensured wide circulation by distributing it to a number of sections. Our appellate practice section did take up the petition and reviewed it. They presented their findings to the Executive Committee and indicated support for the petition. Therefore, I'm here to introduce Mr. Heffernan, who will speak substantively on the support on behalf of the State Bar.
Thank you, Ms. Banky. Mr. Heffernan? This is all just more grist for your book.
It's interesting that you should mention that, because one of the issues that I discuss in the letter, which I believe the court has in front of it, is the Neely decision, and I do have to admit that I take a position on that case in that book, which questions its continuing validity. First of all, let me just say a couple of things about our section's approach to this issue. It was interesting to note that many groups were contacted seeking input on this, and that none of them responded. I think that is more of a reflection of the fact that this isn't really an earth-shattering proposal than it is that there's no interest in this on the part of other groups. And in fact, I think I could state that we don't believe that there's really a pressing need for modification of the rules. Obviously, this court functions just fine, and it could continue to function, and people would continue to know how to move forward, even if these changes are not made. On the other hand, it is our position that this proposal is a valuable clarification of the existing rules, and that on the whole it will be of assistance to practitioners, and that is the reason that we are supporting it. I don't want to cover everything that was covered in my letter, which the court has seen. I will, however, try to address a couple of the main points. I'm glad to see that the Chief Justice noted the comment about the Neely case at page 2 of my letter. As indicated, there was a sense on our board of directors for the appellate practice section that the Neely case has been a problem for a number of years. Of course, it was only interpreting a rule which said that it has to be an adverse position or an adverse decision. And therefore, it's understandable in that context. You had a rule. But now that rule is before this court, I think it's an interesting opportunity for this court to look at the Neely case and to consider whether or not the adverse decision requirement makes sense or is necessary. And the way I look at it is certainly from a philosophical standpoint, this is not an error-correcting court, yet it's ironic that the rule as stated requires this court to fulfill an error-correcting function in order to take a case. And it seems to me that the primary purpose of this court is to make law and to clarify the law. And so from a philosophical standpoint, I believe that there is a lot of sympathy in our section for overturning the Neely decision and changing the adverse decision portion of this rule, because ultimately what it comes down to is this court's discretion to take a case. Now, it was interesting that Justice Bradley had this example of the insurance company. That was one that I thought of offhand about an institution other than the state where you could have a client who appears regularly or has recurring problems. They win on the issue of coverage, but for whatever reason, the Court of Appeals decision sets some sort of a bad precedent. Now, of course, most Court of Appeals decisions aren't even published, but that may change sometime down the road. And to not be able to seek Supreme Court review of a decision which may be precedent and binding on the court system unless it somehow gets up through the back door to the Supreme Court is, I think, a major issue that this court may want to consider. Now, in terms of the floodgates concern, that this is going to open the floodgates, well, I would continue to believe that in most cases, a lot of clients are not going to be willing to take that risk of saying, okay, I won below, I don't like the reasons, but I'll take a crapshoot and try the Supreme Court. There may be, the state of Wisconsin is sort of an unusual position, and they may have a little bit more of an incentive. And there's maybe certain institutional parties like insurance companies that might have a little bit more of an incentive. But I don't see that that the floodgates argument is going to be a real problem. I think it's also important to note that when you look at this proposal, the parts kind of fit together. And one of the keys to this proposal is the fact that this court is allowed specifically to deny petitions without responses. And in fact, I think that's one of the real keys here is that I believe that this rule envisions that the ordinary case is going to be one where the Supreme Court looks at a petition for review, there will be no response, and unless somebody makes some sort of a prima facie case, a response isn't going to be ordered and it's going to be denied. And in that context, I think this court has a little bit more control over this floodgates issue than it might otherwise have. And of course, the other thing about the way this proposal fits together, we heard some discussions previously about, you know, the very detailed response which would be required under this proposal. My first reaction when I looked at that was, you know, this is really upping the ante here. This is making drafting a response a real problem and a real chore for respondents who many times, you know, view this as a waste of time anyway because they know that in 90% or more of the cases, this court denies those petitions and so they feel like they're wasting their time. Well, that's the beauty of the proposal, which essentially discourages people from filing responses in the first place. Because the way this proposal is set up, as I said, it's going to be a very rare case in which a respondent files a response without an order from the court. Because the idea is going to be that this court, in essence, is going to be serving a sort of a gatekeeping function of, okay, we're going to make an initial decision about whether or not this is something which is worthy of review, and we're either going to deny it, essentially ex parte, or we're going to order a response. So I think one of the keys for examining the various issues in this case is the way they all kind of mesh together. Yes?
May I interrupt? I understood the proposal as indicating that we will not grant a petition unless we have given an opportunity for response.
Yes.
Okay, so my concern with that is I hear again perhaps the disparate interests of litigants. Why do a response if the court, it's going to be useless, 90% of the time court doesn't take it anyway, and so we'll do it when we really need it. And yet from the court's point of view, I've prepared for my petitions for review, I've read all this stuff, I'm interested in taking it, well, let's order a response, time is ticking away, there's delay. Then the next month we go over it again. Okay, now I finally have the response, so now I review all the stuff again. It seems there's duplication and delay from my perspective.
I see that, there obviously are going to be cases that come up where this is a no-brainer. This is a case that this court should take, and you don't need a response to determine that. I guess the issue is, and obviously we didn't draft this, but I think the concern is that if you allow the court to grant them without a response, then what Justice Wolgensack says is essentially going to happen is that everybody's going to have, you're just going to have to file a response. Everybody's going to be filing a response. And the whole idea of not having to file a response, saving your client a lot of time and effort in most cases, is going to go down the drain.
And then if we order a response, so if we have 30 days, so nobody does anything for 30 days here, that's a month passes. The court then sees it, and it may take a month for it to get here after the first month is gone because the staff reviews it, right? So now we're in 2 months since the appeal has been filed, since the review has been filed. Comes to the court, and the court debates it, and maybe it holds it over for a month to check it out in some fashion. Now we got 3 months gone. And then the court says, okay, order a response. Well, now what are we going to give them, 5 days? Not likely, because this response is a do-or-die kind of response, because there's a waiver. So what would be a reasonable time for the court to order a response? 14 days?
Well, this is 30 days.
But you want another 30? First of all, you have 30 days to respond. 30 days passes, you don't respond. Now the court's going through its process. It's now going to order you to respond. How many days should we give you, Mr. Heffernan?
I think you should give them the 30 days.
Okay, so now we're in, I've lost track, the fourth month after the petition to file has been done. Now, after 4 months, you filed a response, and now it'll take 30 days for the commissioners to review your response, go over the file, prepare a memo for the court, and put it on their calendar. And I'm assuming everything clicks out right in the 30 days because it's already been all. So now in my fifth or sixth month, and the court even hasn't even made a decision yet.
I understand that.
So you see, that's 6 months. So the question is, where do you put the issue? And you're not going to file it in 30 days. You're going to file a request to extend the time, and that's going to come to my office, and I am going to really be angry. So then I'm going to say, okay, give them 5 days or 10 days, which then becomes 15 or 20, the way the whole system works. So now it's going to be almost, it'll be more than 6 months before it gets to the court. And that just is a huge amount of time.
That's true. And I think, as you've sort of indicated in the chronology you've sort of set forth there, that whether you give somebody 14 days to prepare their response versus 30 days isn't going to make that much difference, because there's going to be this delay built into this anyway. It seems to me that on a practical basis, this court needs to look at this rule from the point of view of, are we going to be denying most of our petitions without a response? Okay? And if the answer to that is yes, then I think you should go with this rule. If the answer to this is no, if the answer to this is we are going to be ordering responses, in a substantial number of cases. And you know, you folks are in a much better position than I am to answer that question. Then you've got more of a problem, because if you're going to take a conservative approach about, okay, gee, I think we'd better order responses on this, and you do that in, you know, 50% of the petitions that come through, then I think maybe you've got more of a problem with this proposal than I think the drafters imagined.
Setting aside the criminal cases and setting this aside that the state is the respondent in most of the criminal cases, not all, but most. In the civil cases, and I haven't looked to tally it, I would bet most, by far, over 90% have responses. They may be perfunctory, but they're there. And then if the court is really interested in the issue or confused about it in some manner, the court will order a response. But, I mean, the number of times we've ordered a response, and we can check with staff afterwards, is really quite limited, because most of them do have a response. But we've ordered them in the criminal cases, too.
Right, and
not many.
And certainly the ordinary and better practice is to file responses to these, and most people do that.
And some justices get really uptight that we're being ignored. I don't care. But some might take personal offense.
And as I said, though, one of the you have to view this proposal as a package, I think. And when you see that there is this substantially increased burden on the respondent in this rule to do A, B, C, D, E, F, and G, if they have to do that, you know, every time, lockstep, somebody files a petition, then I think this is a problem for the practicing bar. But I think it comes down to the question of, does this court believe that it can deny a substantial number of petitions without responses? If it can do that, then I think this proposal makes sense and it's going to work. If it can't, if it has reservations about that, then there are going to be problems.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Henry.
Thank you.
Anything else? Any other comments? No? Okay. Are there any other appearances on 04-08 in re proposed amendments to WSTAT 809-30, 809-32, and 809-62? Not seeing or hearing any additional speakers. The hearing on 04-08 is concluded. And on behalf of the court, I want to thank the presenters and the others making the appearance on a topic close and dear to the heart of the court, namely our appellate procedure, and for the work done on this. I'll now call 04-09 in the manner of the amendment of the rules of evidence.